Greetings and welcome to the Elephant TV. My name is Joe Kobothi. Today I'll be in conversation with Professor Willy Mutunga. Dr. Mutunga is a former CJ of Kenya, an activist, a writer, and a lawyer. Welcome, CJ, to the Elephant.
Okay, thank you, Joe.
Okay, to just get us started, CJ. You know, the last couple of weeks, Kenya is going through another, you know, very tectonic shifts. There's a possibility. It's a possibility. It's not official yet, but there's a possibility of another handshake between Raila Odinga, the opposition chief, and President William Ruto. And you know, right now everybody's running helter skelter with these new elite alignments. In your view, because I mean, you've been a player in Kenya's political scene for the last 30 plus years. What does this new alignment mean for Kenyan politics, but also Kenyan society moving forward?
It doesn't surprise me. It doesn't surprise me at all, because what we have to bear in mind, you know, is that historically, you know, what we call a kind of dictatorship is 60 years old, okay? You have an elite alliance, okay, that people don't seem to see, because we have politics of division and modernization. So you know, the and our elites are not stupid. They have managed to occupy the entire space, all right, and they keep the people basically believing that, well, if Baba becomes president, things will be better. If Ruto becomes president, you know, things will change, okay? And that's as the narrative. Has been the narrative since 63, you might say that, except when KPU was, you know, formed and had a radical, you know, agenda and alternative political leadership. And Jaramogi had a vision, you know, for you know, for the party. So these handshakes, okay, you know, are bound to happen, because they are protecting their class interests. They have alliances with foreign interests, and sometimes even the handshakes are caused by, you know, external you know, factors. So it's a whole question of looking at, and I know a lot of people don't want to do that, is to look at the situation in the world, okay, and ask ourselves whether Kenya actually owns Kenya, okay, or if Africa owns Africa, okay. The colonization has ended, okay. And what you see is that we have been resisting to be free. That resistance to be free did not end with independence. You see it continuously, whether we are resisting our local dictators, you know, whether it's the constitution where we want a social transformation that is good for the country. And these are happening all over Africa, actually, the global south, because the bottom line is the survival of this planet. There is a lot of consciousness growing between global citizens. That's why you find, like, the issue of Palestine. The demonstrations are all over the place. So, you know, the global citizens, whether they are voicing it or not, are demanding a new planet, and they are, which is based on humanity, right? So for Kenyans, you see, elites have kept us concentrating on what is happening, you know, within our country. And so the players are very brilliant mobilizers and organizers, all right? They have the money, so they keep this narrative, you know, the narrative which has emerged of the latter evil. They say, you know, we have two elite factions. One is the lesser evil that will save us, all right? But that actually has also been theorized by some, you know, intellectuals, all right? Which basically means if we move in that direction, that's why we cannot even deal with the stage of the struggle from unipolar world to multipolar world. Right. When it comes to China, you hear people say China will liberate us from Western imperialism, right? So we need, I think, a very, very important discussion at this point on the planet about, first of all, what is there a possibility of a world war three? Okay, because we see a lot of, you know, and when you track back or you trace your history, you find similarities of the root causes of First World War, Second World War, and so it's the understanding of the planet that I think is very, very, very important. Why did socialism collapse in the Soviet Union? Right. What about China? What about Cuba? What about Vietnam? What about North Korea? Okay.
Right.
You know, and these debates are out there. There are people who are arguing that China is in the neoliberal orbit, right? And is struggling to be a social imperialist superpower. You know, there's a lot of those debates, and I think they are very, very, very important actually to, you know, to deal with them, because unless that happens, then the African leadership will not take the right position.
Right.
Okay. And yet, if there is war, we will be the theater. Because Africa has the resources, Africa has everything that these foreign powers want, and we see their forces, you know, in every part of Africa. And so the leadership for me, I don't confine it to Kenya, all right? I don't confine it to Kenya, I confine it to Africa, you know, in the sense that it's high time we go back to what Nyerere was saying, Nkrumah was saying, Amilcar Cabral, the guy called Anta Diop, Sankara, you know, all these people talked about the importance of African unity. So we can't be insular. We need to focus on the regional issues, the continental issues, because I think Africa is facing a very, very, very serious issue of continued theft of our resources, our land, and we can see wars. You know, that's why the ecological issue forgets that the reason why there is issue of unsafe ecological planet is because of these wars, you know. You know, the scientists tell us that the bombs and missiles and so forth make it very difficult for Mother Earth to cool, right?
Right.
So that's my point is, if Raila is going to be the chair of AU, okay, that's great. But it's the leadership that is going to bring them. He has radical positions, and he's well read, you know, on some of those issues I'm talking about. The issue is, is he going to bring that? And even if he doesn't bring it, try to have that dialogue, okay? Try to have a dialogue that, given the situation that Africa faces now,
right,
it needs that kind of of leadership. And I hope he's going to, when he gets in there, he's going to be armed with economists, you know, political scientists, anthropologists, lawyers. He has to have a very serious think tank, you know, that is going to the issues that are flagged.
I mean, however, CJ, I mean, you're hopeful around, you know, his candidacy in the AU, but still, I mean, one can argue, I mean, we are the same in the 90s, right? With when Mandela became president after apartheid, after, you know, post-apartheid South Africa, and then when we had Mbeki following him after, and we had a period of what Mbeki even called African Renaissance. And in a sense, this you know, in a sense, this may be a kind of a kind of moment, just like what we had in the 90s. But if this is true, there were gains, yes, but the little gains were made outside of representation and a kind of what Ban Kagoro calls a feel good Pan-Africanism that came post Mandela.
Right.
So how do you navigate that? Because in a sense, this might be an attempt to neuter the already growing real hardcore grassroots Pan-Africanism around with the youth across the continent, and you know, this kind of shifts we have seen the little history has taught us that it can neuter what's happening on the ground, because now you have, you know, in the 90s we had Mandela and Mbeki and you know, the elders and all these other things. How do we navigate this moment, such that we don't make the same mistakes as we did in the 90s.
I think that's a great point. What we normally forget is to track resistance. To measure the resistance, whether it's coming at the grassroots, whether it's a youth movement, them creating solidarities, that's what was called people to people, people to people Pan-Africanism, and a bit of it took place in 1958, and after that the states came in and they completely killed it. So it's possible, and I think that is something that has to be investigated and researched, because history also records that those who dominate, oppress, and exploit know when to make concessions. Once they see the growing danger to their interests, and the independence is a very good example of that. Where it was very clear that continued colonialism, you know, was just going to cause problems, for the, you know, the British Empire, particularly after the Second World War, when you have another emerging empire in America. There are all these issues again that I think we need to go back to and see whether we are seeing signs, you know, of the past, and the feel good Pan-Africanism is a great metaphor in the sense it's like, you know, there can be a lot of rhetoric about Pan-African, without looking at the issues are flagged of our resources, our land, you know, nation, and even if we take the issue of Congo and look at its history since the airport, those are the issues. Fundamentally, it always comes back to what kind of political leadership is going to spearhead these struggles. So for me, what I call alternative political leadership is that the leadership you are envisioning, you know, people to people, you know, solidarities, and people, movements and political leaderships that are at a minimum anti-imperialist, okay, and are not ready to be, you know, captured by foreign interest, right? It's a difficult call, but I always think that if you have that kind of leadership, that will run to the people when they are being given blows by imperialism, by IMF and the World Bank. Okay, if they come to the people, or they say, our constitution says that we have to consult people, they running to the people at that point. All right,
right.
That's the kind of leadership, you know, that I think is going to be useful. Why would, if we take our current example of Ahiti, for example, okay? Even if the executive is being pushed by the UN, being pushed by the Americans to go and clean their mess in Ahiti, right?
Right.
You know, a nationalist leader or a particular leader will say, look, you've got to respect our constitution. I'm required to have public participation with the president, with the people.
Right.
Even if necessary, you have a referendum. A very quick referendum asking people, what is this? But we have leaders who are enslaved. Okay, so they take orders. And even in the constitution, the courts say, you know, this is not it's unconstitutional, nobody's listening. Even when you hear the legal arguments and the political arguments, nobody's listening. Because why are we actually, you know, sending our 1,000 police officers? I don't know whether they are here or they have gone. Being sent is a suicide mission. Okay, it's a trap. You know, when you check what has happened to Envy, it's been overthrown, right? So there is no authority, and they are going to get in there. And if the so-called gangs are going to fight them, they come together and fight them.
Right.
It's going to be a bloodbath. And I think the leadership in Africa that I'm talking about is the one that will go back to the people the way they did it during the decolonization movement.
Right?
It's the people who are mobilized, you know, to give Mboya, you know, Kinodinga, Mboya with the trade unions, right?
Right, right.
Okay. Others who had peasant following. Okay, and in the communities, I was growing up at that point, and I saw it, how powerful people can be, you know, when leaders are actually pushing for interests of their own country. But the moment they get elected, then getting enslaved by foreign interests, you know, they are paid handsomely for it. And that's a disconnect. So Africa has to go back to valuing the participation of the people, mobilizing them on the issues, you know, that matter. And if that can start, you know, among young people, that's what we'll glorify. And I can see there. It's happening, and I hope it builds a momentum, you know, so that the people are being mobilized to be told, look, the British didn't leave; they are still around.
Right.
The French are still around, you know, and the young military guys have made that position clear, right? You know whether. It's rhetoric or what, but they have been able to identify, you know, problem, and that's how we should look at these things. You know, when the Americans were thrown out of Iran by Khomeini, right? There were a lot of discussions where people basically said, "Oh, you know, he's a religious fanatic, is this and that," but I focused on his anti-imperialist position, okay, for his country, because that was the main thing. The religious thing is secondary, okay. So it's a situation that we have to keep on debating, and the more we start debating it, the way you framed your questions is the way to go, because you are not just dealing with a local issue. You started with a local issue and then brought it within Africa and within the world. That's how we're going to be addressing, you know, these issues, and not just stay within our own problems and what not. The 21st century for me is the century of global solidarities, continental ones, the global south, seeking to mobilize the citizens of the global south to realize that we have the same enemy.
Thanks for that, Prof. So there's an argument that has been made. In a sense, Kenya, as you rightly said, because of the concessions that we make with power and other forces. But there's been a kind of trajectory, if you look at Kenya's history, where you know there was independence, 63, and then there was what happened in the 80s and 70s, the resistance in Kenya, and then you had multi-party 1991, and then 2002, removing of Moi, with now beginning of all these kind of political formations, and then and then we have 2010, the passing of the constitution. My own sense is we don't know where to go from here. I might be wrong. I'd like to get your views. So on one hand, there's a conversation around constitutionalism and how do we implement the constitution. But on the other hand, my question is that what's the next frontier of governance after this? What's the next governance frontier to help the people gain full access of their own freedom, whether social, political, economic. So for me, these are the two questions that are hanging in my mind. How do we move from here?
If we accept that we have a crisis of political leadership, and you can say it's broader, it could be religious leadership, crisis of social leadership, it's a broader issue. But I focus on political leadership because it's the dominant one.
Right.
It's leadership that controls the state.
Right.
Machinery of violence. It's the one that controls our resources. All right. And that speaks to the world in our voice. Right. That's why it becomes, very, very important. And as I've said, if we had a leadership that understands that they have to console the people, they have to mobilize our freedom going forward, by a dialogue, with the people, and that has its own ramifications, political ramifications, because you cannot have dialogue with people who you are stealing resources from, people who are complaining about prices, are complaining about water, everything, all right?
Right.
You can only have a dialogue in that case of the root causes of this, all right? And that takes you back again to the pre-independence days. If it's Mark and Singh and Tom Boy are talking to the workers, all right? There's a very clear discussion that connected our problems to British colonialism, right? Very, 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 very clear. So I think it's a quality of the leadership, and I'm not also underestimating the leadership that the young people come up with, and the difficulties that they face. But that is the way to go. That's That is a way to go. Politics of issues, politics that don't focus on ethnicity, and politics that focus on the material interests of the people. Okay, it's what the constitution calls the building of a united sovereign nation. I don't think we are that as yet. So the trajectory, the way I see it, if you had a leadership like that, there are sites of struggle in the constitution that can be undertaken by that leadership to mobilize the people. Okay, whether you take land, whether you take religion, whether you take environment, whether you take chapter 12, which is finance. There are areas there that although the constitution came in and kind of put them there, and a lot of people, particularly the leaders, think they are abstract, right? But they can be sites of very, very, very serious trouble. If it's Article 43 and you say there is no way we should be paying fees, education has to be free right after university. We have resources, let's use those resources. Of course, that gets you in trouble with IMF and the World Bank, okay? Neoliberal politics. And it takes you back to what I was saying, the movement of people for free fees, for free education, universal health care, all right? It will be supported by the people. And it gives the leadership some political power to negotiate. The coming world is going to require people who can navigate the conflicts that are happening and where they can get something for Africa.
Right.
Not just sit on the fence and watch. It's not going to be easy. Not going to be easy for those African political leaders who go that way. But I'm saying, history records that's how we fought for independence, right?
Before
it was betrayed. So we need to go back to the issue of having great faith, on the people, and discussing the state, of the planet and what has to be done, and how faith in people as the force that can rescue, as a leader,
right,
from trouble. We've had seen before our leaders who actually state that position are killed.
Right.
Whether it's Gaddafi, whether it's Lumumba, okay, whether it's Sankara, whether it's Amilcar Cabral, and in the rest of the global south, you can pick them, right? But the leadership that is being created should be able to deal with that issue. Okay, if whoever is a leader is a matter, right? The movement must produce another leader.
Right.
You move on. Okay, so right. We find out people as leadership it has to be very collective, all right?
Right.
And a leadership that deals with this issue of succession, because we have a history of progressive leaders being bombed and killed. I'm not saying it's easy. Whenever I have these discussions, people think it's just a pie in the sky, but it's a reality. And for us, either as intellectuals or activists, we have to think through these matters and see how they can bring social transformation in our countries.
Right. Yeah. Finally, CJ, before I let you go, at the current moment, outside of the elite consolidation, at least for the majority of Kenyans, there's a sense of disillusionment. Of course, on the economy, of course, I think it's playing an increasingly important role, influencing that in disillusionment. But also there's a sense of 60 plus years of independence, and we're still here. We're still having the same conversations. You know, what next? There's a sense of, you know, in that interlude, that interregnum moment, there's a sense of how do we move out of this cul-de-sac that we find ourselves. So in your view, someone who has been, you know, in this space for quite a number of years, what should we do? What kind of posture should we take in this kind of transition moment we are in?
We should remember what Moi told us. Moi's prophecy was that Kano will rule for 100 years. They have ruled for 60. Okay? Ruled for 60. And everybody who has been in power, either as president or as what in this country, traces their political career to Kano, right? The Kano dictatorship is 60 years old and it will continue, all right? That's what, you know, I see, okay? That's where I base the argument about alternative political leadership, okay? And I've said for a minimum, it has to focus on our foreign domination, occupation, and exploitation, all right? And it has a second one, which is trying to make sure that that leadership is not enslaved by foreign, right? It's then enslaved by people's interests.
Right.
Okay. And I think that's a way you can start, whether you want to call it a small revolution, whether people want to call it a movement, you know. I look at independence myself as a revolution, you know, using that word in the sense that revolutions can also be peaceful.
Right.
Although ours was, there was an armed struggle, but there was an underground and above ground.
Right.
You know, that's okay. And they maybe. Kenya has had examples of that, you know, underground and, you know, above ground, you know, movements. But those movements have always been pro-people. They've always been anti-dictatorship. And being anti-dictatorship, they've also been anti-imperialism. They've never left that out. But what I'm saying now is that is the kind of leadership that... has to grow. We see signs of it, whether it's you know, the Communist Party, and then it's you know, it's dismantled. You see, like the United Front that we had before 2022, it was dismantled. Right. It's not going to be easy. It's not going to be easy because we are dealing with a very powerful elite that is managed and supported by foreign interests. It's not going to be easy, but that's my political diagnosis. I think, you know, we look for those spaces, you know, where we can have this alternative political leadership. And you see people, you know, coming with, you know, with good ideas, but in between, you know, you have these. You know, fights among the youth and among everybody else. But that's how movements grow. Soon there's going to be a consolidation and there's going to be a unanimous voice about what is going on. And that's how people have to mobilize. I always tell the young people that they don't have to be... to think that the situation is hopeless.
Right. Okay? Right.
Our history shows that it took us 68 years, you know, to be independent.
Right.
From Mekitilili, you know, right up to 63, right? And in between, there were resistance that seesawed, you know, you see it growing, then it's smashed.
Right.
But it continues. You know, it continues. And I think that's what, that has been what we have called the trajectory of movements from 63.
Okay.
You know, that's how to be the truth. And it has to, you know, continue. It's very healthy when, you know, as people of my generation, when you look back and you see, oh, well, there are young people who are actually saying what I used to say when I was 35. So you see the trajectory is true, you know.
Right.
What Rodney calls links and continuities.
Right.
Okay, so those are the ones we have to hope for. And I think now it's the youth of this country, the youth of the region, the youth of Africa, and the youth of, you know, the global south and north, you know, to build that consciousness of saving the planet.
Okay. Thank you so much, CJ, for your time here at the Elephant. Thank you for your ideas and your opinion. Asante sana.
Asante sana. Have a great day.
Okay. Thank you so much.